Donna Ainsworth. I was director of ICPJ from 1988 to 1992. I had recently graduated from Yale Divinity School, and I think I graduated from YDS in 87, and I did an internship with Center City Churches in Hartford, Connecticut for a year, and then was going to move to Ann Arbor and was looking for a place to work. And this is the first thing that came up, and I thought, this is the perfect thing for me, and I applied, and I was there. I had worked for Clergy and Lady Concerned in New York City from 83 to 84 on their, before I went to Divinity School, on their Friends of Comiso project, which was about cruise missiles deployment in Italy, in Comiso, Italy. And I had worked at Calc in the national office in Lower Manhattan. And ICPJ was one of the local chapter affiliates of Clergy and Lady Concerned. So I had already known about the Ann Arbor office. I had been doing a lot of social justice work in the church before I went to Divinity School. And then in Divinity School, I was doing some hunger work and then a lot of college chaplaincy. And then in Hartford, I had done, we started a food pantry. The AIDS crisis was happening, and we did local scattered site housing for people with AIDS. So one of my responsibilities, I had task force. I know I had the Land, Food, and Justice Committee, and then I had the Hunger Walk. And then when I was at ICPJ, we started the Middle East Task Force. What I remember most was the Land, Food, and Justice Committee, because I had moved to Ann Arbor because I was moving to smaller and smaller cities, and I thought, land, food, and justice, what am I farming? I don't know anything about this, but I can organize things. So Norma Green had just left ICPJ, and she had been the major coordinator for the Land, Food, and Justice. But it was so foresightful and cutting edge at that point, because I think then all the local people were buying up the big tracts of farms and making them into subdivisions. And farmers were making lots and lots of money, so the Land, Food, and Justice Committee, from what I understood, was trying to stop that. And they did this great, I should have brought my cookbook. I have it. Somebody asked once if anybody had the one, but I didn't want to give mine away, so I didn't say. I still use it, on food made in Michigan. And it was a great cookbook. You can see it's that old font from the 80s. So I organized some farm tours. I think the most successful one was a sheep farm. And everybody brought their little kids, and they sheared a sheep right in front of us. And it was a great introduction to Ann Arbor, because I got to go out to these different farms. Coming from, you know, bigger cities, that was very exciting for me. I also remember writing a letter to the state about something, talking about climate change and how Michigan's climate in 30 years was going to be different, so we should adapt to it. And we are coming up on that 30-year mark, and climate change really is a big deal, like it wasn't being talked about as much back in the late 80s. And now we have all these big subdivisions with all these houses. And people are now going back to trying to do more local food systems. So back in the late 80s, ICPJ was so foresightful on that.
Okay, my name is Ahmed Rahman. I came to ICPJ in late 1992 as the staff in the office and to edit the newsletter. I had been told about the job, I think, by a penny writer and by a woman named Rose Hockman, who he's called a people's realtor. A beloved friend named Rose Hockman, who's not with us any longer. And I had been in prison and came to ICPJ after 21 years, 9 months, and 7 days in prison. So having been in the black movement and involved in activism since the 60s, I had heard about Clergy and Laity Concerned. There used to be an underground paper in Ann Arbor, which I used to always love to read, called the Ann Arbor Argus. It had articles. Whenever something was done in a progressive way, it would have an article about it. So I remember reading about it. I didn't remember that it ever changed its name. So I had applied for the job. I had a bachelor's degree from Wayne State University, and I was pretty computer literate. So I got interviewed by Toby Hannah Davies and a number of other people, and I got hired. And it was somewhat of a learning curve, I remember, because I had never really laid out a newsletter on a computer. And we were trying to switch from laying it out on a table.
That's what I did.
Doing it all on a computer. And the first times I did, like Donna, I had to lay it out on the table, but we were trying to switch to doing it on a computer. And that was somewhat of a learning curve, but I think it turned out okay after a while. But I was pleased to make that transition from being in the Black movement, being in prison, being in the Black movement, then coming to something that was progressive like that, that was dealing with issues like the School of America, which I really, really enjoyed working on, because I knew the history of what crimes were committed by graduates of the School of America. The Hunger Walk, the program where we were feeding people in the, what was that church, Donna? You
remember? Oh, St. Mary's.
St. Mary's Catholic Church. And I just thought that this was just a great place for me to be. Coincidentally, Toby Hannah Davies grew up in Goshen, Connecticut. And one of her mentors and one of her friends who she grew up with was a woman named Madeline Laingo, who was the author of A Wrinkle in Time and all that. Well, Madeline Laingo and I had been a correspondent since the 70s. And I had won the pen writing contest for prisoners, and she had helped to get me my prize when the prison warden said the prize was an electric typewriter, which at the time was the next step above the manual before we had computers, of course. And the warden said, he's not a writer. He's not getting any electric typewriters, right? We're not going to allow it in. And Madeline Ingo had the Deputy Secretary of State of the state of Michigan come and hand deliver the typewriters. Right, right. And the warden and all of them just shut up. So I was, interestingly, I was talking to a Toby one day. And Toby said, I said, where are you from, Toby? She said, Goshen, Connecticut. I said, well, you know, I have a friend in Goshen. She said, who? And I told her, Madeline. She said, I grew up in her house. You know? And so I thought that was so coincidental and great thing when Toby told Madeline where I was. And Madeline said, well, he got out, and now he's somewhere like that. And how great it was.
Chuck Werpahusky, I currently serve as the director of Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice. So I started in January 2003, a little bit over a year after 9/11. So that was a huge influence on the organization I was stepping into. It was interesting hearing you, Ahmed, talk about laying out the newsletter, just switching to digital, because when I took over, I remember Russ Fuller teaching me how to lay out the newsletter in the digital format. But we still had to drive the files down to Tecumseh and run it. This is 2003, but we're still running it through the half toner there and still doing that final paste up in live. So there was still, you know, so you were going from the transition from all paper to mostly digital, and I was sort of going through the transition from mostly digital to all digital. And one of the things that I remember from walking into the office those first times, I remember my interview, the chair I was sitting in for an interview, it didn't have a right armrest. We were sort of like scrabbling together, used office for, but Bill Ingraham was our board chair at the time, and he was saying, yeah, but that's because we want everybody to lean to the left. Those are just some of those first memories of stepping into the office and getting started.
Yeah, we had to drive that newsletter down to Tecumseh. And I remember that old paste board, and I would go crazy trying to get it all straight. And now I look back, I think, now it's so easy. In design, you just, like, email it to the printer.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went down to Tecumseh with Toby. Well, she said, we got to wait a while and to pick it up. It's not ready. And let's go to a restaurant. So I didn't know anything about Tecumseh, Michigan, but I had heard the guys in the print shop talking about how Tecumseh, Michigan has its own lifestyle and way of life, and people drive here all the way from Detroit because they don't want their children to grow up in that way of life. They want them to grow up here in Tecumseh. So I'm listening, and I'm trying to say, well, these kind of sound like some code words for something here. So Toby and I go into the restaurant, right? Everybody in the restaurant is white. I walk in with this white woman, and it's like everybody just stopped talking. They just stopped eating. It reminded me of that movie with Eddie Murphy, you know, where they go into this hillbilly bar and everybody just freezes, kind of. And I said, Toby, don't you feel like there's something different going on here? Toby was so oblivious to any of it. It was like she didn't see any of it at all. So I didn't say anything, but it wasn't comfortable. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned Reverend Fuller, and I really appreciated Reverend Fuller because I had been in prison, you know, all those years. And I don't know how much he knew about me, but I know it was in the paper when I came out and all that. And I got out in November of 92. And I think I started really working around January. So after 21 years, I had a month to kind of, you know, get reoriented. So I came into the church and I knew they had money from the collection. They had all kinds of stuff. They had computers and stuff. And Reverend Fuller told me, he said, and his wife Barbara said, we just want you to be comfortable here. We want you to know that you're welcome here. Nice to meet you. And, you know, they just wanted me to relax. You know, and what I saw in the Fullers, you know, I've dealt with, you know, people who were white and say, well, I'm not a racist. But, I hadn't really dealt with that many people who were just actively anti-racist. And I really appreciate that in Barbara Fuller and in Reverend Fuller. For me to be able to come in and be welcomed like that into the church family, into the ICPJ family back then. It was just great for me to reorient myself to being free.
When I started at ICBJ, the office had just moved from the First Methodist Church to Memorial Christian. And so, like, tripled in size, which wasn't saying much, but.
I heard that the room where our office used to be in First Methodist, they made it a little study nook, but it's downstairs under their Wesley Foundation Lounge. It's tucked around a corner, so it's hard to see. And they've got a little couch there and a little table there. So it's now called the makeout room. So now that the office that used to be Memorial Christian is now a fraternity,
oh, right.
I really worry about what the what the whole, that room is.
The whole building?
The whole building. They sold it as a fraternity.
Oh, isn't that something?
I edited the newsletter also. And I started this series coming out of divinity school. I was a more religious perspective. So I started this series in the newsletter asking different religious leaders to write about their and their denomination organizations' perspectives on peace and justice. Rabbi Dobberson had just come to town, and he did one. That's how I first met him. And he's been there, so, like, 25 years already. But, you know, I sort of called him out of the blue, saying, can you get this to me in 3 weeks? And there it showed up. It was really great. We also, we hired Toby, and sometimes I feel like that's one of my great claims to fame, hiring Toby. And Toby, of course, conducted this lobby effort to get hired. So she had three different people call me to tell me that we should hire her. And I started getting annoyed. Harvey Guthrie, who is the rector at St. Andrews, called me at home, and I'm like, oh, come on, I don't want to hire her because, you know, she's just too annoying. And Mary Hathaway said, you know, it shows what a good community organizer she is. She's just dogged. I'm like, okay, that's a better perspective. But she and I worked together for, I don't know, a couple of years.
Right, and working on the newsletter was a good way for me to learn the whole panorama of what ICPJ did, you know, because it was new to me and I didn't know many of the people, but working on the newsletter, I had to interview some people, talk to them, and I just saw from the articles that ICPJ was doing a lot of really great things.
One of the things we did for the Hunger Walk is we had to decide which local organizations to give money to. And I so enjoyed going to these different organizations saying, we want to give you money. That was a really fun part for me. That's how I met Carol McCabe, who actually wasn't at, now she's at Avalon Housing. She started Avalon Housing soon after that, but that's how I met her. She was at another, you know, social service agency. But it was a great way for me to move to Ann Arbor because I got really integrated really fast and know all the churches and everybody's address and all that stuff. The mailing list was always a big problem because, you know, we were just going to computers then. So we actually had to go to the Friends Center to get to use the computer and the mailing list there. So technology was a big changing issue then. I mean, technologies just took, or lack of it, just took a lot. Things just took a lot more time because we didn't have the technology. Well, the volunteers, we'd have a mailing party like every Tuesday, and we had some really nice volunteers who were such good workers and an integral part of. We had an ABM club, which is a buck a month. Do you still have that? That Lael Weinert ran, and she had small children at home, and she's like, this is one way I can help. So somebody would write a letter on some current issue every month, and then then I would bring the letter and all the copies to Lael's house, and she would mail it out, and people pledged monthly.
One of the things that I had thought about was how the issues that came up, because it wasn't always, you know, we're just in a paradise of lefties, you know. We did have some contradictions. We did have some conflicts that came up, and I liked the way that we were able to resolve the conflicts or come to some kind of resolution without just falling out with each other. I remember when the Salman Rushdie thing happened, and he wrote this book, Satanic Verses, of course, which infuriated the Islamic community. But other people were saying, well, this is a free press issue. And I was saying, well, if somebody were to write these kind of things about Judaism, they would be denounced as an anti-Semite. And you all wouldn't be supporting them, right? But they can write these things about Islam, and it's a free press issue. And so we discussed it and debated it and whatnot, and I put my article of what I thought in the newsletter. And Toby didn't agree with it, right? But Toby didn't stop me from putting it in the newsletter. And she just said she didn't agree. She was more into the free thought, free press. Everybody should be free to express their ideas. And she didn't see that the Islamic community, that it had, I thought, a valid reason for being offended by the things that Salman Rushdie wrote. And you know, not to the extent where I thought he should have been killed, that I told her should have put a hit out on him. I thought that was crazy, just like that Charlie Hebdo thing is nuts, you know. But still, I think that we all have to respect each other's faiths and what's sacred to each other, and that Islam shouldn't have been placed in that kind of zone where it's, you know, a free-for-all in denigrating its most sacred personages or beliefs. And that's freedom of speech. But that wasn't a contradiction that really made us not be friends, that made us not work together. And there's other things that pop up periodically, but I like the way that we were able to maintain an atmosphere of collegiality, of friendship, and still get the work done.
I remember when I asked Rabbi Dobberson to write that piece for the newsletter on Judaism. He said, well, you know, I'm not a pacifist. I was like, you know, you don't have to be anything. We want to know what you think, and that's why we're giving you this platform.
Yeah, and I remember Toby and I, we had debates about that, about her absolute pacifism. And Toby, I said, goodness gracious, if pacifism was right all the time, then my people would still be slaves in Mississippi. Goodness, there was a war, you know, to free them. The South said in 1862 that they weren't going to free slaves for 100 years. That meant I would have been born in slavery. There had to be some violence at some point, you know. But Toby, no, violence all the time is wrong. Toby, but you think Hitler would have just accepted a nonviolent demonstration against him and stepped down? You know. So we these are the kind of discussions that we had, and I appreciated, you know, in that dialectic, hearing the other opinion, you know, and I think we kind of learned from each other and we modified each other's opinions, because I think there are situations where, of course, pacifism, you know, is correct, you know, but then I think some situations where it can't be correct. But the fact, these are just some of the issues that we would discuss among ourselves, you know. That in other organizations, I think they have split on these kind of issues, you know, but we never did.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've seen for the most part within ICPJ is able to be trying to find the way to hold that tension. So during the war in Iraq, there were some people who said we need an immediate withdrawal. Some people said a phased withdrawal. Everybody agreed the war was a mistake to get into, but now we've made the mess. How do we get out of it? And there were people who were pushing from one side or the other to make a clear statement. And there's that constant effort to say, no, we've got to find, there's a space here for critique. We've got to hold a space that says the current strategy isn't working. We need something different. But to let those different voices keep their individuality. And if we had pushed for a narrow party line, we would have lost a lot of people. The time we weren't able to hold that so well was with our Middle East work, when we had a group that was actively picketing a local congregation, distributing texts saying that Judaism, through its religious observance, turned young little Jewish boys and girls into monsters. And when they were trying to set the framework for our work on the Middle East for Israel-Palestine, that just about tore the organization apart. So that was one where the passions were so high, the tensions, because it touched on both of our peace and justice mission and our interfaith part of our mission, we tried really hard to resolve that one, to find a way to keep that dynamic tension.
Well, the Middle East Committee always existed when I was there, but it's I believe that the conflicts, the contradictions, heightened, so much, because I remember we had a Palestinian woman. Matter of fact, we had a couple of Palestinian women. You remember one? Remember any of them?
Yes. Rabia Shafi.
Yeah, that might have been her.
The one.
We had some Palestinian people, and we had some Jewish people, and some Muslims, and we, everybody knew what the conflict was, but the goal was peace, and that was the goal. But peace. And with the acceptance of some of the Jewish people that the Palestinians should, right where we are now, the Palestinians should have their own state, right? There would be peace if both sides have their own state. But the conflict has got, because on the campus where I teach in Dearborn, we have, I think, 16% of our students are Muslims, right? And they've gotten to the point where there is no discussion between the Jewish students and the Muslim students. It's just, they just can't discuss it anymore. It's gotten so totalistic, where we want all of Jerusalem always, forever, for eternity, and you can have none, or we want all of Palestine, and you are illegitimate. And that didn't exist in the Middle East Committee when I was here at ICPJ. But I can understand that contradictions have been heightened so much now that there's probably not much dialogue, huh?
Yeah, for me, one of the warning bells was shortly after I was hired, just a month or two in, so I was still quite green, and there was a discussion as to whether or not to pass a boycott, divestment, sanctions resolution. Mm-hmm. And at the Middle East Task Force, somebody said, well, I'd like to talk to some of our allies in the Jewish community about this and hear what they have to say. And several people were saying, no, we don't even want to hear what they have to say. And when there's that sense of that you talked about, that dialogue and that dialectic, when there's like, we don't even want to hear it, that to me was, in retrospect, sort of that had gotten, that was the beginning of the end for our ability to work productively on that issue.
Well, that was many years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, even on the campus, we have conflicts among faculty. We had a vote on the BDS, and it lost by, I think, six votes. And the kind of rancor, between people who previously, had been friendly colleagues, the kind of rancor that it dug up, it's just striking that this conflict is just so divisive, It's very powerful. So I don't think it's ICPJ's fault, right. Because it's just part of the times that we can't get to that point where we want a two-state solution. Anymore. Now, that was something that Jews and Christians and Muslims could come around. But now, there just doesn't appear to be that anything that everybody can say, we all agree with this one position.
On a contemporary basis, though, I think it was the right decision for ICBD to focus, where can we find that common ground? And I've seen it really exciting this year around our food and justice work. We had a program right here in the Ann Arbor District Library at the beginning of the season, and it was that great dialogue. Different, we had people from Muslim, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, Unitarian people saying, here's what our faith tradition teaches us about food and caring for the hungry, or food and caring for the land that brings it forth, food and caring for the workers that produce it. And, you know, then that's the teaching part, similar to what you're doing in the, with the newsletter, Donna, of what do people teach, and now it's been a year of trying to figure out, okay, that's what we should be doing, now let's get to work actually doing it. So that's been a great example of respecting the differences and then finding the commonality to work together.
I remember the Palestinian woman because she played an important role in my transition. When I got my first apartment, I had a lawn chair, a bookcase, a telephone, a sleeping bag, and a book, you know, and that was about it, you know. And I didn't have any furniture, I didn't have anything really. And one weekend, she said, "Well, I'm moving some stuff to my garage. Could you help me? Because I'm getting some new furniture." And I went to her house, and she said, "See that table there? It's so 70s. Do you want it?" So it was a glass. It was a glass kitchen table, right? With red velvet chairs, right? With chairs with red velvet around them, right? She said, "Oh, that's so 70s. I said, "Yeah, I'll take it, you know." So I got that. And then there was a woman who was going, her husband or somebody was from Bosnia, and this was during a big conflict with Bosnia and Serbia. And she was moving to Washington, D.C. to do some lobbying. And she said, "Well, could you help me load my stuff on the U-Haul?" So word gets around that I'll help people move.
Right. Did they pay you?
Look here. I had, they paid me, but I wound up with three televisions, right? I wound up with one of those little Apple Macintosh computers, like two stereos. I had all kinds, my apartment was so full of stuff, I started giving away. I had a whole bedroom set I gave to a guy who got out of prison after me, right? And I remember my dad came to visit my apartment, and I got the apartment because of Rose Hockman, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, "Rose, I tried to get an apartment, but they want to do a credit check, but I have no credit." I said, and having no credit is worse than having bad credit, because I had zero credit, right? I'd never got anything on credit in my entire life. So she said, "I'll take care of it." And she knew somebody who was the vice president of McKinley, the big mm-hmm. realtor. And I got an apartment overlooking the swimming pool, right? At a discount, like half price, you know, some kind of subsidy that Rose had them hook me up in, right? And I had all of my apartments just laid out with all this stuff because I've got real choosy now. So I remember my dad came to visit my apartment. He said, "Who did you have decorated for you?" So Donna, your husband was, you know, always really deeply involved in the organization, you know? He's an idea man.
Mm-hmm. He sure is. He sure is.
Oh, yeah. I got to contact him. I got to get back with him. Cause
does he have some idea for
you? He sprung an idea on me. You know, because the idea for the thing we did at the Michigan Theater.
Yeah,
he sprung that one on me. I said, "Oh, great idea." But he, about a month ago, he sprung another one on me. I can't remember what it is, and I was really caught up. I got to get back to him on that.
Politics of Empire.
Is that the one?
That's what he's working on.
Oh,
now.
That's big. That's the that sounds like him.
Yeah. What's bigger, the politics of the universe? We're going to science fiction next, right? The whole universe.
At least we're starting with the Earth, right?
But you guys seem to have been such a great team. You know, you got a lot of teamwork going. That's before your children came.
Yeah, I watch the kids, and he goes off to meetings at night.
Yeah, no. I remember. Before Ruby came, you know, you guys were a team, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's how I know when you got out of prison, because Ruby came to the party at Penny's house, mm-hmm. and she was a baby sleeping in the other room. So that's how I know when you got out.
Right. And I remember coming to your house, you guys invited me for dinner, and Ruby was making such a mess with the spaghetti. It was like, all over. And, you know, I'm like, aren't they going to stop the baby from making this mess? But you got, you know, I said, oh, hippies, what, you know, what can I say, you know, hippies, but, you know, You know, she was eating it and it was all over her face and all red.
Yeah, we were probably amused.
Yeah, right.
Mention who your husband is.
Joe Summers. He's Episcopal minister of the Episcopal Church of the Incarnation. Yeah, at that point, when I started ICPJ, I was on ordination track in the Presbyterian Church, but then I decided to get off. I had done everything you need, almost everything you need to do to get ordained in the Presbyterian Church. And I had my divinity degree, but then I was like, you know what? I'm too much of an agnostic to be a clergy. So I was much more interested in doing peace and justice, social justice, campus work. And so now I'm working on campus, and that's great. You got Toby on this?
Oh, that ought to be a good one. We used to call it Toby Wan Kenobi. When I once told her that's what we called her, she didn't smile. Yeah, but she was quite an activist and quite had a lot of energy. I really liked her energy and her dedication and commitment, you know.
Yeah, now she's in Kalamazoo doing similar stuff.
Similar stuff, yeah.
And, you know, Chuck followed in her city council footsteps. The whole thing about city ICPJ directors becoming city council.
Are you on? Did you make
reps.
It?
Yeah, I'm on city council.
Kim Groom was also on city council. She was before me.
That's good. There's so many changes in Ann Arbor. My goodness, you know, my mother was born in Ann Arbor. Everybody from Ann Arbor, you know Catherine Street? And right after Ann Street? Well, my mother was born on Catherine Street, and her name is Catherine Ann. Very creative of my grandmother, right? But so I used to, you know, come there. I have dozens of cousins, and my aunt just passed last year. She was here, my mother's sister. But I've got dozens and dozens of cousins. So I used to come here in the 60s when I was a little boy, and I just remember how the city looked back then. And they used to live right across the street from the University of Michigan Hospital. That was residential back then. And Carytown all the way down to Depot Town, that was the black community and all that area. Fourth and Ann, that was the black strip right there. That was the center of the black community. That block, my cousin, he owned the record store. And another cousin owned the pool hall. But there's no black community like that in Ann Arbor anymore. Everything is changed.
Oh, but there's a plaque now.
Hmm?
There's a plaque now for where it used to be.
Plaque, yeah. And
Division was really dividing street.
Mm-hmm.
I think Division divided the university and maybe the black community, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, the Wheeler Park down there in Depot Town, right? You know, now that before they named it Wheeler Park, that was still the black community's park, right? But one side of it was the slaughterhouse and the other side was the garbage dump, right? So that's why they gave them that land. It was the slaughterhouse and the garbage dump. So you can imagine.
And the floodplain.
You can imagine what it smelled like down there, you know? But, you know, you go up that hill now and goodness gracious, the houses and the gentrification and the money and golly, to remember when that was the black community, you know, that was the black community.
That's one of the things we're doing more, for a long time, a lot of our focus was on the international issues, and we're still doing that, but we're putting more and more effort now on some of this local stuff, and we've got a history of picking some long fights, you know, picking some long odds, but trying to figure out 9 of the top 10 jobs that are growing in the county don't pay enough to raise a family on. Mm. And so trying to find what are the ways we can try to deal with some of these local economic justice issues. But a lot of people agree with us. But trying to figure out, okay, and here's X, Y, and Z to do about it has been, you know, it's different than just than organizing a march or organizing a farm tour. But it's, you're right, the ways the communities change the direction it's going and trying to make sure it's an inclusive community it's going to be a big fight. And that, you mentioned some of the food stuff earlier in the crop walk and meeting Carol McCabe. I think one of the other parts that I'd be interested in hearing from you about is I see other sort of ripples of ICBJ's legacy over the years, right? So it's not just, you know, before the Delinas Center was open, there was the Food Coalition? What was it?
The Hunger Coalition, I think.
Which I think grew out of ICPJ?
It could have. I don't know. It wasn't when I was here.
And Religious Action for Affordable Housing and all these other ripples throughout the community of trying to...
Yeah, I think Religious Coalition for Affordable Housing was... Niall Harper started that, and he was retired from the Ecumenical Campus Center. Mm-hmm. And he was a real mover. He was really... but I'm not sure much more about his involvement. Although I do try to Google him every so often.
Did ICPJ have a role in these sister cities that Ann Arbor had, like Hikone in Japan? Because, you know, the whole Hiroshima Day program, which I remember was really a great thing that we used to do in the park.
Yeah, that was fun. That was, that was great.
Right, and so I know there's a number of sister cities now. It's Hikone, and I don't know what the other ones
are. Well, Huigalpa?
Huigalpa, yeah.
Is that, yeah. Well, and the Religious Coalition on Latin America, was that an ICPJ? Yeah.
Yeah, so there was, the Latin America thing was, there was the Latin America Solidarity Coalition.
And that was like a
sort
campus
of the secular in campus, and then there was Religious Coalition on Latin America, which then is now our Latin America task force. But yeah, the efforts to start the sister city with Huigalpa had connections with a lot of those. So we've got pictures. There's something in the Observer recently. We've got pictures of the dump truck that Tom Riki helped. You know, he's in publicity, right? So he helped figure out this was. It was just a great visual of driving the dump truck down to Huigalpa during the Iran-Contra war.
Right, Marianne Perón was really, really active in the Latin American issues, and you know, she was somebody who kind of educated me about it. I knew about liberation theology and about Oscar Romero and all that, but I didn't know the participation level of Americans in the Central America and donating money to build schools and raising money for refugees. Marianne Perón, she's still active, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Driving force. Right, yeah.
We had a great program, what was it, last year about Oscar Romero?
Yeah, that was at St. Mary's.
Oh, St. Romero now.
That's right.
He's going to beatified, but not sainted yet.
He's on his way.
But the interesting thing is, hearing the whole coverage of the right-wing death squads and being assassinated, saying mass, in NPR, NOCA talk about how it was U.S. dollars that were training.
I remember organizing the first anniversary, I think, of the assassination of the Catholic sisters and with Shirley McRae in like 89 or something like that. And there I was at the 25th anniversary again. Another thing that reminds me of was the alternative holiday fair at First Baptist Church every year, which was a much more like a free fair trade. And that, I think that finally stopped after 25 years because there, you know, fair trade is, and buying things is just changed so much. We have the 10,000 villages and you can buy more fair trade things online. But that was a great thing that sort of ran its course.
Well, you talked about how with the food injustice stuff that was getting off the ground when you moved in, that ICPJ was at the cutting edge. I think that's the case. We were at the cutting edge then, and so we're so successful with that fair trade movement that, you know, when there's a fair trade store right on Main Street and so many congregations are doing their own fair trade sales to be able to pull people in, you didn't need a special alternative holiday fair. That fair trade option wasn't as alternative. It was more mainstream.
Yeah.
Right. I remember I like staffing the booth at Art Fair, too, because I just get to meet all the great people and pass out our literature. And, you know, you can talk to a lot of people at the Art Fair. You still got a booth?
You know, when we started looking at how much time it took us, and we like, if we had a good year selling our bumper stickers and whatever, it would turn out all right. But most of the people we were talking to were from out of town. So in terms of trying to build our membership, build the organization, we didn't see it really helping. You know, we didn't see it was the right way to spend. Because even though we had volunteers for every 2-hour shift, I was still there every 2 hours making sure people actually showed up.
Oh, I remember that. And I just moved to Ann Arbor. I moved here. I started ICPJ in June, and Art Fair was in July. And I was like worrying about the rain and worrying about the old ladies staffing the booth in the rain and what they were going to do.
How it always was.
Staff time intensive.
And then when the rain broke our booth one year and we looked at the cost to replace it, it was, okay, this is we'll take this as a sign.
Well, for me, I think being, this is just a personal thing, but being able to continue my social justice work and having ICPJ being the perfect way to move into a community and get to know all sorts of people and get settled, it was a great introduction to Ann Arbor for me.
Right, and for me, having come out of prison, it was really kind of like a soft landing. And introduced me to a community of like-minded people where I had a sense of continuity, that I came into prison involved in political work and fighting against the Vietnam War and against racism. And now I'm with a community where I'm just continuing that. And some really great friends, I just like the way they open up their homes to me, Donna here and Joe and Marianne Perrone invited me for dinner, and the good friends that I made at ICPJ that continue to be friends.
And maybe say a few words about where your journey's taking you after ICPJ.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, I got admitted into the University of Michigan PhD program in history. I was actually the first person in the state of Michigan to be admitted into the University of Michigan Graduate School while in prison. And I was admitted into the graduate school in prison, and because of the prison hassles, the university told me that, to make a long story short, that see us when you get out, because, although you did well, we can't, I had two tutors coming up, and I was had lectures on cassette tape, and the guards would hold the cassette tapes, and the professors on campus said, just keep up with the class and you'll be all right. The guards wouldn't let the cassette tapes in for 2 to 3 weeks and said that the professors might be smuggling drugs in the cassette tapes. I had two tutors were coming in. They would hold them up in the visiting room before they would let them in 3 to 4 hours. And so they just said that the university told me when I was in prison, they said, see us when you get out, because we can't send our personnel through these kind of hassles anymore, stress. So when I came to the university, I said, they told me to see him when I got out. And I met some people, some friends, and some very progressive people who had the Baker Mandela Center. You remember Barbara Ransby, yeah. Tracy Matthews, and all of them. And Barbara Ransby was getting a PhD in history, as was Tracy Matthews, was getting a PhD in history. And I always was a history buff. And I asked him, how did I get in? Because I told him I had been in before. They said, there's this guy. He said, PhD costs a lot of money. And there's this guy who's in control of all the money, right? And you got to go talk to him. But they said, he's not going to do anything for you. We can just tell you, right? He's not a cool people. He's not going to do a damn thing for you. And you're going to wind up not liking him at all, right? But they said it won't hurt to ask. So I went in there, and I'm trying to figure out, what am I going to say to this guy? I go to his office, and I said, nice to meet you. I said, you're the person that everybody told me is going to help me. You're the one everybody said that if I want to get in this university, I should talk to you, because you're the one who's really going to look out for me. He smiled from ear to ear and said, what can I do for you? He said, what can I do for you? And I told him I wanted to get in the PhD program. He said, what's your GPA? And I told him what my GPA was. And I said, you can check all that on your computer, because I was admitted to university when I was in prison. He said, yeah, I read about you in the paper. And then he called in the secretary. Remember, they had the newspaper with me on the front page of Detroit Free Press the day I got out of prison, right? So he shows it to the secretary. This is him. And I shake hands. So they got my name and went to the computer and said, here he is. And I got the fellowship for the PhD and went through all that. And had I but known how much work it was, I'd have gone to law school. I really would, because I had a friend at Wayne State University Law School and asked me, said, you want to get in law school? I said, man, I've been looking at law books for 20 years. I can't stand to look in another law book. I was in the library all the time trying to get out of prison, right? I can't stand it. It'd break my brain. But my goodness, I didn't know how much work it was. And I know Donna actually warned me and told me that it saps all your energy. And I'm like, oh, shucks, I can do it. What the heck? Over in Africa twice doing research. I got cholera. I was in a country with a military government in Guinea. And let me tell you, what a military government means is that the soldiers make the laws on the spot. That's what a military government means. And the soldiers have those AK-47s, and they say that your car is not going down that street unless you give us 20,000 francs right now. And are you going to give them 25,000 francs? Or you certainly are. And so I went through a bunch of stuff, but unless I had gone through that and done these interviews and went to these countries, I couldn't have written my dissertation, because I wrote the proposal saying that I was going to go to do all this stuff. But it was work, but it was worth it, and I got through the process, and now I'm teaching at the University of Michigan in Dearborn.
And I've been at the University of Michigan Women's Studies Department since I left ICPJ and seen it grow tremendously.